celebrating 30 years of broadcast excellence. Now back to the Evening Rush with Earl Ingram on 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town.
Welcome back once again to a Wednesday edition of the Evening Rush. We'll go directly back to the phone. We'll go to the phone lines immediately. Al, how are you doing? You have a question or comment
for
Director Bonds and State Representative Williams.
Good afternoon, everyone. I heard Polly said it seems like it's always about the money, but it is about the money. And I think sometimes the politicians lose the fact that there are a lot of us trying to stay in our homes, and we don't make the salaries that the politicians make. I'm pretty sure we don't make the salaries that Polly makes.
Oh, honey, my salary is
state representatives, does it?
Right, we make 47, I think.
And okay. We make a school board member make
18.
Less than that, significantly less than that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, these are the wrong politicians you're talking about.
But when you look at your tax breakdown for the city of Milwaukee, it's like per thousand, it's almost $8 that goes to the whole city budget, and it's $8 that goes to the school budget. So we're saying that the equivalent of your taxes you're paying for the schools are equivalent to, like, the whole city budget.
Well,
that doesn't make sense.
Well, it makes sense if you understand the state funding law. Right now, in the state funding law, MPS raised property tax for the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program, which it has no control over. Last year, MPS raised $257 million. 20% or $58 million went to fund the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. So when you look at your tax bill, you see all these dollars there. This isn't just for one school system. It's for two school systems. They just don't break it down that way.
But your counterpart there helped introduce the choice program.
Yes.
So how is she going to help us balance out what's being basically sucked out of our pockets to pay for two school systems?
Well,
I can barely hang on to my house because I'm trying to pay $4,000 a year in property taxes.
Well, let me just tell you the bill that I passed, I sponsored about 20 years ago. It was never our intent, those of us in the original fight to get parents to be able to make some choices about their children. It was never, ever intended to create a second school district. That happened after we got the program started, and then other people then began to get involved and kind of steered this to where it is now. But that was never my intent when we did this. It was just we had intended for it to be on a small scale as a way of demonstrating that when parents are involved with their children's education, that the children would do better in school. But it was never our intent to create the second largest school district in the state.
Can I comment?
As part of one of the resolution that, a piece of legislation that State Representative William is introducing, it does deal with one of the parts of the financing thing with the revenue cap, which is part of legislation, but also two of my colleagues have been very, very aggressive and influential in trying to get the funding flaw changed relative to MPS raising property taxes for a school district that has no control. President Blewett and Director Morales has worked with the school funding network, and now it's actually is reaching a legislative point where hopefully we can make some changes to it. But right now, MPS is raising funds under state law for a school district it has no control over. So when you see your property tax bill, all those funds are not going to MPS.
Okay, but doctor, who has the right, who in the city of Milwaukee has the right to set the levy for the city of Milwaukee schools?
The school board has it, but there's a state law that requires, it doesn't give you an option, it requires you to go to the revenue limit or else you lose state aid the next year. And one of State Representative Williams' legislation is, she's introducing that you won't be penalized if you don't go to the revenue limit, because the way the current law is set up is if you don't go to the revenue limit and you save you get penalized and you lose 38 cents for each dollar that you save. For example, if you cut $20 million this year, you get $7.6 million less next year.
Okay, I'll leave you with this last question, Polly. When you're up there on the Hill, think about it, though. If you price some of us black elderly and black young folks out of our homes, pay for the Milwaukee Public Schools, you're losing your allies.
No,
all right, Vincent, thank you very much for the call. Amanda, you're not, I mean, Al, and you're not elderly. All right. Okay. Veronica, how are you doing? You have a question or comment?
Fine. How are you?
Just fine.
Hi, Polly. Hello, Mr. Bonds.
How you doing?
It was funny that the host mentioned the fact that the kids are eating the
cheese and
bread and cheese at school. I was at a school today where it was in the morning announcements, if your parents do not pay, you will have to have the cheese and bread for lunch.
That is just terrible.
It actually was said in the school this morning. I said, oh, these people, what's going on here, really?
Oh, man.
And the other thing, Mr. Bonds, when did you come aboard the school board?
2007, April 2007.
Last year?
2 years ago.
2 years
month.
Ago, 2007. Okay, the guy that was on the phone about his property taxes being mm-hmm. raised and...
Ms. Dale.
Yes, and what or how we're going to go about straightening out MPS. It is a big problem, and I don't think anybody that takes over the issue is going to be able to straighten it out anytime soon. I was an MPS student. My kids were MPS students. And I think for the most part of it is if we don't get inside these houses and get these single moms involved in their children's lives, that this is just a revolving door. It's
well,
just a revolving door, you know.
But I understand what you're saying, but there are a lot of these moms are overwhelmed.
Yeah, they are.
And just look at what has been happening over the last few weeks with these moms and their infants.
Yeah,
you know, right. And they're trying to. I know a number of them. They're trying to do as best they can, but they don't have a light. The safety net is not there for them. They don't have. A lot of them don't have a support system where they can make a call to someone or go drop the kids. Like my kids, my children could always drop the grandkids off by me. Or if they need a ride, they can call me. If their car breaks down, I can go take them. A lot of these moms don't have that kind of help. And going to school is the last thing on their mind when they have to take their babies to all these daycare centers, get to these training programs, a job that just paying minimum wage, they're overwhelmed. And I just think that we need to, people like us, need to try to figure out a way to help these moms.
Yeah, we got to reach out to them. State Representative Williams, you were talking about a meeting that...
Yes, the Education Committee on Education Reform, when we were talking about the report from the consultants. And so we're going to be having, I'm the chair of the Committee on Education in Madison. We're meeting this Friday, the 24th, at 10 a.m. In the state capitol, room 413 North, Madison, Wisconsin, at 10 a.m. And we're going to be, what the committee is asking the state superintendent-elect, Tony Evers, and the Milwaukee School Board of Directors to come. And basically we want Tony Evers to talk about the fact that he, the DPI, what is the district, because MPS is a district in need of improvement.
Yes, under the federal No Child Left Behind Act.
That he can take some major steps to do something to try to correct the problems. So we want to hear from Superintendent-elect Tony Evers, and also want to hear from the Milwaukee School Board members about their feelings about the report, where if some of those recommendations are carried out, it just appears as if that board, the school board, some of their powers might be taken from them. And so we have, I got several members that said that they would be in attendance, of course, Dr. Bond, Director Blewett, Director Jeff Spence, I think Director Falk is already in Madison, and they probably stopped by, And, of course, Bruce Thompson said he was not able to make it, but he wanted to meet with me later. And, of course, we had Director-elect Miller possibly would be there. And I don't know if we sent the notice to the new board members, so hopefully some of the new ones also would be in attendance to give their input and to say what their feelings are about this report, because the school board is really the ones who decide how the money is spent for the running of the public school system. And if there's going to be a council appointed, who then will come, who would have the fiscal responsibility for spending the money, and that's, I have some concerns about that.
Dr. Barnes, you were kind of disappointed in the amount of people who showed up at the board meeting on the other day.
Oh, not just the other day, throughout the year. One of the things as a board member I find frustrating, we're dealing with a $1.2 billion budget, and we're talking about 80,000 kids' life and their families. And sometimes you look in the audience and it's empty, or sometimes you see a couple people there, and usually it may be people who's getting looking for contracts or getting appointed. And then sometimes if there's a school closure or maybe a major program mistake, you see people there. But for the most part, the meetings are generally not well attended, in my opinion. I don't think there's too many other issues than ones on kids' education that's more important. I understand that some of the meetings can be late, and but it's the nature of the school board. You have a part-time school board where people work during the daytime. The meeting starts at 6:30. It's scheduled to start at 6:30. It doesn't always start at 6:30. You have numerous items to go to. You try to allow for public input and everything. Right. And sometimes the meetings can go to 2, 3 in the morning.
You see, and I think that particular structure is set up to, yes, to not have input from the public, because at 6:30 in the evenings, if people have a job, they have to come home, yeah, and cook their meals and help the kids with their homework. And so it's set up. That's why, you know, I have introduced legislation to have a full-time school board where they get a comparable salary, and also they have a staff. And that way they can have meetings like the city council, the county board, the state legislature at a reasonable time. But because the board members don't have that kind of support staff, they rely on administration, and they don't, the board members have their regular jobs. But I do know if we were to get a full-time board, then people like Dr. Baum may not be able to be on the board,
right,
because he's a professor at UWM. So it's six in one hand, half dozen the other.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. And I want to make sure, really want to get you guys back in as soon as possible. Dr. Barnes?
Yes, thank you, Earl. And thanks for inviting the state representative when you're met. But one thing I want to emphasize, while we have challenges in MPS, there are a lot of positive things going on. And voters had an option of replacing people that they're not happy with. But to have people come in, oversight, where you have no accountability, I don't think it would be good for the district. And all the research I've seen, when mayors take over or you have appointed board, the middle class and upper class students win out, and low income and minority students lose out. So when people come out with these simple solutions for complex problems, I would caution people, because if those solutions was that simple, they would have been implemented years ago. Because every urban school district in America has major challenges. As I mentioned, I was at a conference 2 weeks ago, and Secretary Duncan talked about Chicago. It took 10 years before they started seeing the changes in Chicago, and our Atlanta principal talked about 9 years. And there's no such thing as a quick fix, because you talked about the homeless, the electricity, but Milwaukee has one of the highest poverty rate. It's the seventh poorest city in America. We get to talking about 60% of black males unemployed, the change in family structure. There's major challenges that impacts students, but students can learn regardless of the background.
And they do.
But for people to come in with the simple solution that we're going to appoint few people to have all these magical powers, I'm like, Okay.
Give you a break.
Okay. We're going to make sure we bring you guys back in where we got some real time to deal with the issue. And I want to thank you very much for coming in. And we'll certainly make sure we get you back soon. All right. You're listening to 1290 WMCS Talk of the Town. When we come back, Sheriff Clark will be in the studio.
This portion of the Evening Rush is being brought to you by Wendy's. Wendy's, eat great, even late. It's way better than fast food. It's Wendy's. Also, the economy in Milwaukee may be challenging, but there's help at Bryan and Stratton College. Come to their Midnight Madness open house taking place Thursday, April 30th from 9 a.m. until midnight at both campuses, downtown and Wauwatosa. Call 276-5200. That's 276-5200 for more information. Call now.
Celebrating 30 years of broadcast excellence. Now back to the Evening Rush with Earl Ingram on 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town.
Welcome back to a Wednesday edition of the Evening Rush, and I want to thank State Representative Annette Polly Williams and Dr. Michael Bond, School Board Director, for spending some time with us. But we have the one and only Sheriff David Clark back in the studio. How you doing, sir?
Wonderful, Earl. How you doing?
I like that shirt, man. You gotta let me know where you got that
Thanks.
Shirt.
It's a Michael Kors.
It's what?
A Michael Kors.
A Michael Kors.
K-O-R-S.
I got to figure out what that is. I asked my wife, man.
I didn't know either until somebody saw it on me and said, hey, I like that shirt. It's a Michael Kors. I got a couple of those myself. That's when I looked at label. I guess it is.
Well, maybe I won't, you know, if I put it on, I've gained a few pounds, it probably won't look as good. Maybe got to do something to figure out a way to take something off, man. That shirt looks nice on you, man.
Thank you.
All right, but we're not here to talk about how good you look, because I guess many women tell you that, man, in the audience. And I know you're married.
It matters is my wife, right?
Yeah.
I don't hear it enough from her, though.
I've been married for 30 years. I know the story.
Yeah.
but anyway, I really wanted to get you in, man, to congratulate you for turning around and doing something that many thought was impossible to do, and that was to change the climate and the atmosphere of what's going on over at the House of Correction. You know, when it was first talked about you taking that over, there were people who said, how is he going to be able to do that when he has his hands full, you know, with the Sheriff's Department? And you were able to kind of shut people up real quick. Now, either you know something with smoke and mirrors, or you happen to know law enforcement.
Well, you know, first of all, thank you. And the credit, though, really goes to my staff. That's where the work gets done. You know, I set the vision, the direction, and then I turn people loose to, you know, use their talents and skills, knowledge and ability for results. You know, I'm a bottom-line guy. The only thing that matters in my world our results. And, you know, this is a work in progress, and I try to temper people's enthusiasm. No, I mean, you know, I did it with the Journal Sentinel writer as well, and I want to caution the public that it's just a first quarter look. It is optimistic. There's no doubt about that. I'm not going to downplay that, but it is a testament to the transition team that I put into place. When the county board decided to make this policy shift back last year in October, you know, I had a heads up that this was going to come down, and I agreed to take it on. You know, I'm a change agent. I like to take things that are in need of great change, things that might be broken, things that might need to be improved. I like those challenges, so when someone says to me it can't be done or you can't do it, I always silently say to myself, you watch, I'll show you. But there's a model to this. There is no magic. There's no smoke and mirrors. It's an organizational change model, and it starts with setting a vision. It starts with direction. It starts with a sense of urgency. It starts with changing the culture. And all that is doing is laying a foundation for the change to take place. That's not the change itself. The change comes, you know, later on that you see. I mean, that's something that is very evident. And, you know, I went in the day after the county board made it official that January 1st it would come under my domain, I attended all three roll calls over that 24-hour period to address the troops, so to speak. And I wanted to make it very clear to people the change that was about to take place. You have to keep people in the loop. You know yourself, Earl, that change leads to resistance and people right. fight it. But one of the reasons that I've learned in this organizational change model that people fight is because it's not communicated well to them and they don't understand what's coming. So that if you give them a heads up, they still might, you know, not be fully on board right away, but at least they can't say, well, I didn't know what this was going to be about or you didn't involve me, so on and so forth. So I went out there and gave them my leadership philosophy so they could learn a little bit about me first. You know, they have to.
So you didn't go out asking opinions.
But I wanted to know what their concerns were because right. I brought that up too. I said, make a list of your concerns, get them to me. I'll address what I can. We'll right. discuss the other ones that I can't because it's always a two-way street with me. But I told them that my leadership philosophies are that change is necessary, that crisis is opportunity, that problems are challenges, that I have an intense belief in what I'm doing. And I put myself second to this. It's all about the organization. And then I laid down my expectation of what I expect from people because I said we're going to do three things here in the first year. We're going to change the culture, and that's just simply the way people behave. We're going to balance this budget. They ran $5.4 million in red ink last year. You just can't do that with other people's money. And I said we're going to manage overtime because the overtime was out of control. And I let them know that customer satisfaction is job one. I told them that the only thing that matters is results. I told them that our mission statement is going to indicate that performance matters here. My standard is one of excellence, not perfection. Some people will, you know, say, oh, he expects perfection and people to be perfect. No, human beings, that's not the human condition to be perfect. But it is one of excellence, which is a very high standard. And I think that if you continue to be in pursuit of excellence, you'll get close to perfection.
Well, then why is your gig line always straight, Sheriff, if you're not in pursuit of perfection? You know what the gig line is, right?
Expect the best?
Yeah.
Yeah, the best. It doesn't say expect perfection. Right. But you're right. It's a high standard. And the reason I set the standard that high, I mean, that's kind of the way I was raised, but the reason I set it high is if you set high expectations of people, most oftentimes they'll meet it and they might even exceed it. But if you set it at a level that they can reach, first of all, those that are highly motivated might not see that as a challenge. Remember, I said my first one or one of my leadership philosophies is that problems are challenges. I need a challenge. A lot of people that are highly motivated need a challenge. If there's no challenge, it may still need to be done, but they're nah, it's not. Someone else can handle that. So I set the bar high with an expectation that people can meet this thing. So the culture change really centers around a sense of urgency about what we're doing. And I got this sense of urgency definition and idea from, you know, I do a lot of reading. John Right. Cotter's an author, professor at Harvard University, has written several books, one on organizational change, managing change, one on what leaders really do, and then his latest book is A Sense of Urgency. And he describes a sense of urgency or defines it as a compulsive drive to respond fast, to move and win now, that we have to work smarter, faster, and we have to do it today. That's what a sense of urgency is. And I want to instill that in everybody at the complex in Franklin. This is what I've done in the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office that I've been doing for the last number of years. And so I've done this before. I had that experience going into the Franklin job that I didn't have the first time around. I didn't have the experience of doing it. So that's where that confidence comes in. You know, when I said I have an intense belief in what I'm doing, not arrogantly, but, you know, I've done this before. I've studied it enough, and we apply that same model. I didn't invent the model, but it does work. And one of the things that John Cotter, the author of Sense of Urgency, indicates is you need a fast start. Remember, I said you got to be smarter, faster, and today. Right. So I thought that if we put a transition team together, which we did back in December, a lot of people said, well, don't you want to wait till January 1st?
Yeah, you moved on it right away. I remember.
That's that sense of urgency that I wanted to exhibit, not just tell people about, but I wanted to lead by example. So I put a transition team together led by Inspector Richard Schmidt, Inspector Kevin Carr, and Captain Nancy Evans, who was a lieutenant at the time, put together a staff around, you know, they put together a staff and put a transition plan down on paper. I don't do anything without a written plan, right. A plan to succeed. And it's an action plan. There's got to be action, not just nice words on paper, right. Promises about what you're going to do. And they did that. And they worked intently on that during the month of November and December so that by January 1, we could pull the trigger and get this thing going and get off to that fast start. And that's what this first quarter is. We have a long way to go. There's no doubt about that. But it is a good start. But now what I've done is I've moved the bar even higher for these folks to – and I know they'll get there.
But you saved $5 million. And let's not fool anybody. People who are used to making an awful lot of money in overtime certainly did not accept that with, you know, with the arms open and embracing you because you came in and – people would probably say took money out of their pockets and kind of changed because there are people with $30,000 in overtime in a year. You were able to change that, but that certainly didn't come without people, you know, kind of putting a target on your back. That has to be a very difficult thing to change the mindset of a person when you're also changing his finances.
Right, and like I said, we're in the process of this. That $4 million, excuse me, of red ink is, you know, something that we have to. That's what we're going after.
Right.
We're just in the first quarter, but you know, you're right. But I indicated before that this isn't about me, and you have to. I said self is secondary, and that's when I, you know, for me, and I let right. people know this isn't about me. This is about the organization, and so when you put yourself second, you really learn to brush off what people are saying, and you're right. It can have these kind of impacts on people. But, Earl, these are publicly owned assets. This is other people's money. And I remind people, overtime is not a cash cow. It's not a cash register. It's a management tool that's entrusted to me by the county board as a resource to get certain things done when in the regular course of business it doesn't get done. Not to be used by the employee when they want to go buy a new lawnmower. And that's really the thing that sets in. There was an article in the paper not too long ago, maybe within the last 10 days, about how people at the state level were making $50,000 and $60,000 in overtime. Well, not in a straight wage.
Sam Clark hasn't gotten up there yet.
in overtime. And I don't begrudge people who, you know, want to take the overtime when it's available and you know, people need to make a living, but you can't gouge when you're in the public sector. I tell people, if you want to make real money, you got to go into the private sector if you want to make real money. You can make a nice living in the public sector. It has served me well, but you're not going to get rich, and I'm not going to let you try to get rich because it's other people's money. And if you don't use it efficiently, what happens is you run out. You run out before the budget year is over, and that's how you start running red ink.
Well, Sheriff, we have to go to a break now. All right, we got to go to a break. When we come back in studio with us is Sheriff David Clark, and we certainly got some other questions we want to ask him. You're listening to 1290 WMCS, the Talk of the Town.
There's nothing more important.
Celebrating 30 years of broadcast excellence, the Evening Rush on 1290 WMCS, the Talk of the Town.
Welcome back to the Sheriff Clark Show. Oh, my mistake. That's another story. Sheriff, we were talking off the air, and I was saying that I remember when Sheriff Clark first became the sheriff, the county sheriff, and you said we are going to change the culture. At that point in time, I forgot maybe there was something had occurred with many deputies that were kind of an embarrassment. To the sheriff's office, and you came in right away and said, we're going to change that culture.
There was,
and I think you've been able to do that.
Yeah, it's the formula, the model that I followed in terms of organizational change. And the one thing that's highlighted in that model, that plan, is the need to change the culture. And as I indicated,
but you make it sound like it's easy to change the culture of people.
It's not at all. Changing behavior is a long-term process. I'm nowhere near it with the facility out in Franklin, which we call the Correctional Facility South, formerly the House of Correction. It takes several years to change a culture, but that's why you got to lay that foundation. You have to get rid of complacency. You have to be willing to fight the status quo. This stuff is exhausting. It is all uphill. It's against the current. All those phrases, it's tiring. There's no doubt about it. You have to renew your sense of urgency every once in a while to continue this fight. It's a huge battle. But if you don't do it, none of the other changes that you want to see down the road will ever take place, because people will always revert back into the behavior that they, you know, that this is the way we've always done it. And that's all part of human nature. So a big part of this, too, in organizational change is understanding human behavior, what motivates people, how to get them to buy in, to give them a chance, so to speak. But a big part of it, too, Earl, is sometimes you have to change the people. You got to change personnel.
Right.
Some people have to go, and others that you can sense, because I don't believe just because somebody comes up to me and hands me a line that sounds good that they're on board. I got to see it. I got to feel it. I got to know it. I have to sense it. And so you have to change personnel to get this done sometimes. People leave. They just, you know, see that it's not for them. They leave on their own. I give them credit when they do that. Others will stick around saying, I'm not leaving. I'm just going to fight and fight the change and fight some of these other things. Those are the ones that aren't so fun. But remember I said part of my leadership philosophy is that I have an intense belief in what I'm doing, and I keep reminding myself that I'm going to win in the end. It may take me a while. It may be unorthodox, but in the end, I'm going to prevail. And it's that sort of attitude that I think starts to become evident to people who are looking and saying, do I want to stick around and deal with this? Do I want to continue to resist and fight this? I think they start to see it and say, you know what? Yeah, I think this guy is in for the long haul. And then they got a decision to make.
Let me ask you this, because obviously right now with Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen, talking about concealed carry and saying it's legal, and I kind of heard your opinion on it. And what is your take on concealed carry?
Well, there's a number of issues here surrounding that that uproar that he created yesterday. I was disappointed in J.B. Van Hollen for a number of reasons. First of all, my philosophy and my belief, I execute the laws. I enforce the laws. I don't make the law. So once a law is made, you know, whether I agree with it or not is secondary. Remember, self is secondary. I have to carry it out. But the thing that J.B. Van Hollen did, he issued an advisory memorandum. An advisory memorandum is not binding. It is not, doesn't have the force of law. Even mentioned in his release, and I have it right here, it says advisory memorandum from his office, and it says here, that an advisory memorandum does not carry the same legal significance as a formal opinion. He didn't issue an opinion, but it seemed like he did.
So what would be the purpose of him even?
Well, he sent mixed messages. Yeah. That's one of the reasons why I'm disappointed. We need clarity on this issue of whether citizens have the right to, well, they do under certain circumstances. Wisconsin is only one of two states that doesn't allow people to get a permit and carry a firearm to defend themselves if they so choose. I believe that citizens need that right, and it is in the Constitution. Okay, not the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It's in the state constitution. And again, I said I execute the law. I carry out the law. I don't create it. So it's already there. But there's an orderly way of doing this, and 48 states have set up a structure for people to get a permit if they want to, and you know, you get the background check. You have to qualify with that firearm. And then there's certain other restrictions that a state under their police powers can put in there to allow citizens to do that. That's the clarity the state needs. Are we going to do that and follow the Constitution, or are we going to leave it in limbo? This advisory memorandum that he issued yesterday does nothing. It just confuses the issue. It clouds the issue. And I likened it to throwing a cigarette down on a dry, grassy field and then walking away, setting a brush fire, and then allow the chiefs, the sheriffs, and district attorneys to have to deal with it. And that's not the way to do this. He gave no advance warning that he was coming out with this. I think he has a duty and responsibility to do that, to let the chiefs, the sheriffs, and district attorneys, we're going to have to execute this. I'm coming out with this. I'm going to give you 30, 60, 90 days. Yeah. I'll give you advance notice. You're going to have to, change this, because for me there are training issues. So the heck with whether I think this is right or not. We train a certain way to deal with gun offenses, a man with a gun, how we tactically approach. That becomes second nature to a cop. We have to now deprogram our law enforcement officers to respond in a different way for someone who legally is carrying a firearm. You don't handle them the same way as you do with somebody who might be carrying a firearm for illicit purposes. He gave us no time to adjust our training to deal with some legal issues and questions surrounding. He just throws the match down or the cigarette on the grassy field, starts this brush fire like we see in California with the wild, and then he walks away. And lets the fire department, lets the chiefs, sheriffs, and district attorneys have to come and put the fire out.
Well, Police Chief Flynn was clear, and he did not think it was the right thing to do either. And he certainly, again, I'm like you. I don't know why at this point in time it was so important that the top cop, J.B. Van Hollen, would put that on the table and create the confusion that he has done. And I'm wondering if he realizes now that was a mistake.
If he did, he needs to come out and correct it. There's nothing wrong with that. We all make mistakes.
Everybody makes mistakes.
You come back and you say, hey, there was some misunderstanding. It was an advisory memorandum. It wasn't an opinion. And, I should have done X. I don't like to tell the Attorney General what to do. I'm not a lawyer.
Right.
People are in the business of telling me what to do all the time as a sheriff, and they've never been a cop and have never been an executive of a law enforcement agency. So I kind of guard against that. But he did throw it in my lap, and so I feel a need to respond. Now, whether you agree with whether people should have the right to go armed with a, concealed or open weapon, the fact is, if it's going to happen, there should be an orderly process for it, which is what, the permit type thing. And what states have found that have gone to this initially, I'll give you an example of Minnesota. When they went to concealed carry with a permit, they estimated that 25,000 people would apply for permits when this thing opened up. Only 9,000 did. You don't see this mass exodus of, or not exodus, you don't see this mass rush of people to go get a permit to carry a firearm. But this advisory memorandum issued yesterday, it allows anybody, as long as they're not a felon, I understand that, but you don't have to train with the weapon. You don't have to qualify. There's no background checks and some of the other things that go along. And then what areas do we not want these guns in? They put in schools. That makes sense.
Yes.
School zones. Some of the other areas, I think churches.
Yeah.
We don't want them there.
Grocery stores,
I threw this one out. What about public transportation? What about buses? You want a guy with an open firearm on his hip getting on a crowded bus. So this thing hasn't been vetted properly, and I would rather have had J.B. Van Hollen, again, not telling him what to do, go to the state legislature and say, hey, the CCW law is in conflict with the Constitution. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has already said that. In an opinion they issued. And whether you agree with it or not, we're a nation of laws. If we don't like the laws, we need to change them, but we shouldn't just say to hell with the law. The legislature never acted on it. This is from back in 2003. They said your CCW statute is in conflict with the Wisconsin State Constitution. You need to fix this. They didn't. I would rather have had J.B. Van Hollen go to the legislature and say, we're going to resolve this. I'm going to give you 90 days, 180 days to rectify this conflict with the CCW statute and the right to carry. Otherwise, I'm going to issue this opinion. That way, at least you give people a heads up. Remember I talked about the need to communicate change with people ahead of time so they know what's coming down the pipe, and give the legislature time because they make the laws. That's the way our government is set up. The legislators make the law. The executive, the governor, I'm part of the executive branch in that I carry out the law enforcement. And then the Justice Department, the judicial branch kind of rules on the constitutionality if there's conflict with the law. That's where our system is set up. And this allows for an orderly process of governing, not just throwing an inflammatory thing out there, which doesn't have the force of law. And really, it says right in here.
Well, it's certainly got J.B. Van Hollen's name out on the forefront.
It says an informal advisory memorandum does not constitute a formal opinion of the Wisconsin Attorney General. But the way this was issued, it seemed like it did. He just said, people can openly carry
firearms.
But he
got the spotlight. And sometimes people long for that. People hadn't been talking much about J.B. Van Hollen, and now all of a sudden we are. So
this isn't the way I want people talking about me, man, And I don't know. That's for him, too, his right. reasoning behind it. But there is confusion now, more so than already existed. And I needed clarity. Chiefs need clarity. Yeah. Sheriffs, district attorney, the public needs clarity. Those that want to carry a firearm really don't know yet. They go, well, he kind of said I could, but I might get arrested. So the public's not clear on what's going on here. And this can still be fixed. I know that Leon Young proposed to introduce some legislation to prohibit it, but that's not the answer either. And I'll tell you why. It's not going to withstand court review because the Wisconsin Supreme Court already ruled on this and said you can't just outright bar a person's right or ability to go armed with a concealed and or open dangerous weapon. So it doesn't make sense to me for Leon Young to introduce that legislation. It's not going to withstand a court case. So they need to craft legislation that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has already spoken on in terms of what can and can't happen with the Constitution on this. Craft it around there. Let's have an orderly process if people want to do this. You can still not agree with it and whatnot, but at least we know who's doing it. We know they've qualified with the weapon. We know that they've had a thorough background check. They're mentally stable because by federal statute, if you've been judged mentally incompetent, you can't carry a firearm either. So we'd have all that sorted out. And then we'd have a database that if one day the police approach and find someone with a concealed weapon, we could check a database. Yeah, that guy's got a permit. It's so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. We don't have a database, and that's why this open carry means anybody can do it, and we don't know what the heck's going on.
Unfortunately, it's going to be, and I shouldn't say unfortunately, it's going to be 86 degrees or thereabouts on Friday or Saturday. When it gets to be this time of the year, you start rolling out your initiative down at the parks and at the lakefront. Unfortunately, the clock on the wall kind of has us behind the eight ball on that. And I need to see when we can get you back in with more time so you can talk about that initiative that has been another success. There was a time not too long ago when people felt unsafe down by the lake.
It was an intimidating environment. It turned into that, unfortunately.
You put your mark on that, too. And so many people go down there now and feel very comfortable.
The bad guys.
Well, they don't hang around much anymore, right?
Right.
I don't know if you do this stuff with whips and chairs or if you do this by osmosis or how you work it out. But
good planning.
You seem to be able to get people to follow the directives that you give. And that's what leadership is.
It's right. It's a testament to the people that I've surrounded myself with. The leadership mentors that I have read about, studied, met a lot of them. They all say the key is to surround yourself with great people. They say people who are smarter and better than you and turn them loose to do what you need done. And that's when you'll be successful. So I appreciate the compliment. But I'm still going to pass it on to the team that I've assembled. We don't, like I said, we don't do anything without a plan, a written plan, and that allows us time to sit down and think it out, vet it. What are the pitfalls of this? And, we try it sometimes on a pilot project before we announce it to see does it need to be tweaked. And we have a better success that way. So I'm not the smartest guy on the block but I don't need to be.
But you also said you have to make sure, too, that the people you have with you on your team, that is one of the key elements also.
That's the bottom line. Surround
yourself
with...
You don't have to look behind your back.
People like Captain Aisha Barco, who... no, she's one of the ones I elevated, that I promoted. And it's people like her and some of the ones I mentioned earlier. You know, Captain Evans, Inspector Schmidt, Inspector Carr, Deputy Inspector Bailey, Don Kohler, my executive assistant. I got a great staff. I put most of them in place. So if I do fall on my face, I don't have myself to blame.
You know, one thing for sure, Sheriff, it doesn't look like you're going anywhere, anyways, near soon.
You know.
I mean, you're still a very young man.
Well, I look at, you know, tomorrow's a blessing, and it's been promised to no one. So I take life one day at a time. Yes. And you got to have the support of people. I'm glad to have your support. The support of the public. Not everybody. You're never going to get,
right,
you know, everybody to agree with you and support you. That's not the point. It's to get enough. To get enough momentum going for progress, and then allow some of that momentum to carry along with the fight. Because, like I said, it's swimming upstream.
All right, I know we got to run because she's playing the music. And up next will be Debo. He's going to be in for Phil Anderson and Blues After Dark. Sheriff Clark, as always, it's great to have you in, and we're certainly going to bring you back really soon because we got to talk about the summer initiative. And we never didn't get a chance to get into all the things that I wanted to get into today, but, you know, you'll be back.
It's my pleasure. It always is. It's good to see you.
I do listen to you.
And
all right. Well, I'm struggling with that.
If I leave you alone, I don't call in to argue with you.
All right. And I want to thank again Polly Williams and School Board Director Michael Bonds and you, Kira, and more than anything else, the listening audience and 1290 WMCS for giving me an opportunity to come before the community. You're listening to 1290 WMCS, The Talking Tone.
The views and opinions expressed on The Evening Rush do not represent that of 1290 WMCS or its advertisers.